S-C-O-O, San Francisco, baby, baby!
Shiba, shiba! Shiba, shiba! Shiba, shiba!
Let me in!
Shiba, shiba!
I wanna be closer to you!
Shiba, shiba!
Open up your soul!
Shiba, shiba!
Let me find that part of you! The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your mind.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something, understand something. It's the last Monday of the month, so later on I'll be speaking with Janine Moganum from the San Francisco Public Library. But coming up right now, it was a rebroadcast of an interview I did with a scintillating scientist a while back, so I hope you enjoy it. Ambassadors, I'd like to welcome Jet Thompson. Hello.
Hello, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. So, Jet, tell me a little bit about what flavor of science you do.
Sure. So, I'm a particle physicist. Mm-hmm. I'm a theoretical particle physicist. So, this is what if you're familiar with things like the giant particle accelerators over in Switzerland, or there's one up in Chicago where you're ramming the smallest particles together and seeing what comes out and trying to understand the basic building blocks of the universe. That's sort of the classic version of what a particle physicist is.
Okay.
These days, we've sort of branched out a little bit.
Uh-huh.
We do, like, my group spends a lot of time thinking about astroparticle physics, where you're using, you know, the universe way out there gives you a bunch of stars that ram into each other, make a massive explosion, and We can use that to learn about the basic building blocks. So The core goal is always understand what makes us up at the smallest scales, and we use whatever tools we have at our disposal to do that.
Okay, so I want to start with, do we know all the particles that exist, or are we still discovering new particles?
So by definition, this is a virtually impossible question to answer, because if we knew... We never know what we don't know,
right,
for sure.
Are we still discovering,
yes,
particles?
With that being said, there is very, very, very good reason to believe that we do not know everything yet.
Okay, good.
So we understand very well a whole collection of the particles that make us up.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I would say, one of the greatest successes of physics over the past 100 years, has been really understanding that at the smallest scales, you're made up of atoms, and inside those atoms are protons and electrons and neutrons, and inside the protons and neutrons are some other objects which we call quarks.
Mm-hmm.
And so understanding this tower of building blocks is really something that we worked out over the course of the 1930s to 1960s or 70s. And then over the past few decades, we've put in the few final puzzle pieces of what we call the standard model of particle physics. This describes very well virtually everything we see.
Okay.
However, it turns out the theories, the physics theories that we have these days, are much smarter than some of the theories that we've had in the past.
Okay.
And one of the ways in which they're smarter is they sort of naturally predict where they will run out of predictive power.
Oh, okay.
So they naturally predict, say, energy scales at which we sort of start to expect new physics, because there are certain problems in the standard model that we do not yet have solutions for.
Mm-hmm.
So in this regard, I would say it's extremely likely that there are new particles, new physics somewhere out there that we haven't found yet. There are also some other major problems that years ago would not have been thought of as particle physics problems, but now we really do think of them that way.
For example?
For example, maybe you and some of your listeners have heard of dark matter, which I can tell you in about two sentences what we know about dark matter, and then I could tell you in, hours and hours and hours what we don't know about it. we look out into the universe, we're able to do very good measurements of how much mass is out there, mm-hmm. just how much stuff. Mm-hmm. And we can do this in two different ways, basically. We can do this in two different ways. One is we can sort of measure how much mass is gravitationally attracting. So, for example, if you looked at the solar system mm-hmm. and you very, very, very carefully measured the radius of the Earth, the Earth's orbit, so not how big the Earth is, but how far the Earth is from the sun.
Okay.
And you also measured how long it takes the Earth to go around the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So you measured, 1 year to make one full orbit.
Okay.
This turns out to give you some information about how heavy the sun is.
Oh, okay.
So this is one great way to measure mass of stuff, and we can do this on giant galactic scales. We can also measure mass a different way, mm-hmm. which is we look out, we can just count the number of stars we see mm-hmm. and the amount of sort of hydrogen gas we see, for example. And we know roughly how much each star weighs, and we know what the density of hydrogen is, so we can just calculate how much mass it is by seeing what we see. This is just like, you know, if you were able to look at the solar system mm-hmm. and you were able to measure the size of the sun directly and you knew the density of a star, then that'll tell you how much mass is in the sun. So there are two different ways to measure mass.
Okay.
In principle, they should give the same answer.
Yeah.
They don't.
Oh.
So this is really exciting. This is telling you that we're missing something.
Okay.
And what we see is the mass that gravitationally attracts. So the mass that you get if you measure how far, you know, how fast things are orbiting around
mm-hmm.
other things
mm-hmm.
is much larger than the mass of stuff that we can see. So the mass that's contained in all the stars we can see mm-hmm. and all the hydrogen gas that we can see. Whatnot.
And why is that? Have they figured that out yet?
No, we have no idea. This is a huge gaping hole in our understanding of modern physics. This is what we call dark matter. It's basically the statement that there is a lot of matter, mass mm-hmm. out there that gravitationally interacts. That you know will cause you can see that it's there because you'll see a star orbiting around nothing. But we don't know what it's made of. So this is another case where originally this problem sort of started way out in astrophysics and cosmology. You know, people are looking out at the universe and taking detailed measurements of the largest scales that we can probe
mm-hmm.
with massive telescopes. But once you realize that there's something new there that we don't understand, that can't be any of the normal things that we are familiar with,
mm-hmm.
then you start to think, well, probably that means there's some new particle that we haven't discovered.
Okay.
And trying to understand what that could be.
Okay.
So, yeah, when you ask, do we know everything? The answer is always no.
Right.
But the understanding why exactly we don't know things and how we know that we don't know things, I think, is a very interesting, interesting question.
So aside from, I have a few questions. Aside from the dark matter question, are there particles in space that have been discovered that don't exist on Earth, that you've only discovered through exploration?
All of the particles that we are aware exist.
Mm-hmm. Like the periodic table of elements.
Yeah, like we have produced or measured here on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Although many of them don't sit around in your everyday life because they're very short-lived.
Sure.
So the place where we've produced sort of, I'd say, the most of the particles when, you know, the laboratories that we use for these are these particle accelerators.
Mm-hmm.
So the U.S. has one up in Chicago or over in Chicago. At Stanford actually has a particle accelerator that used to be one of the highest energy particle accelerators in the world until
mm-hmm.
they built bigger ones elsewhere.
Okay.
The biggest one that people may have heard of is the Large Hadron Collider, or CERN, over in Switzerland and France. And these are just custom-built laboratories to produce new stuff
mm-hmm.
By ramming the stuff that we have together very fast. And
mm-hmm.
turns out when you just shove a lot of energy into a very small space, then you'll get new particles.
Like these hybrid stuff. Particles?
Yeah, it's one of the great new things that One of the great new things that we learned about physics in the past 100 or so years, there are a couple of pieces to it. One is energy and mass are the same thing. So this is Einstein's famous E equals MC squared. So if you put a lot of energy somewhere, you can get heavy stuff. And the other is quantum mechanics, where unlike classical mechanics, which is, you know, blocks on inclined planes and your car going down the highway or something, classical mechanics is very deterministic. You know, if you drop a ball, it'll always fall exactly the same way. Quantum mechanics, there are probabilities attached to everything. So there are chances of certain things happening and chances of other things happening. And when you combine these two things together, what you end up understanding is that if you shove a lot of energy into the same place, there is a chance to produce almost anything, as long as you have enough energy to produce it. So if there's some new, weird, heavy particle that we've never seen before, all you have to do is shove enough energy into a small enough place and wait and do that many, 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 many times, and eventually you'll produce it. And so this is how we've discovered most of the particles in the standard model.
I gotta say, like, if I had one of those you know, colliders, I would just think it would be the fun, like, what would happen if we shoved these two together? It'd be like making Reese's peanut butter cups, but out of particles.
So I think in many ways I'm very lucky to be born when I am and have, you know, I have many more opportunities than I would have if I had been born 100 years ago. However, in physics, I think by far the best time to be in particle physics would have been in the 60s or the 70s, because this is 50s or 60s or 70s, because this is when people were sort of starting to understand these things.
Yeah.
It was like the Wild West. Anyone could just go into his lab and, you know, build a little collider and ram stuff together and see what came out, and, you know, random little groups of people would discover a brand new particle that's now been enshrined in textbooks and all of these different things. You know,
so are you saying that back in the day people could just like build a particle collider in their garage if they wanted to?
Maybe not their garage, but, you know, if you were a physics professor working with a few other physics professors, you could get something, you know, you could cobble something together. Whereas these days, if you want to build a new particle collider, you know, the most recent one that we've built, the most recent big one that we've built is the Large Hadron Collider out in Switzerland.
And
there are thousands of people that have to work on it, and it's a giant 24, 26 mile ring, and, you know, it takes huge amounts of money to construct and to run, and it's you know, it's still really exciting, but it's now a big industry. You need a lot of people working together. You know, civilization has come to particle physics, whereas before it was just, you know, out on the frontiers, the few lone explorers or whatever.
So tell me about how you got into first science in general, and then how you decided on particle physics. So when was your first like, ooh, I love science?
Good. So they may be listening. I'm not sure. So I have to be careful what I say. They were both physicists. They were both trained as physicists, and they were both particle physicists, but they were experimentalists. So they actually met at the collider, the particle collider over in Chicago. So I grew up, I was homeschooled. My parents both ended up leaving physics and doing other things. But I grew up in an environment that was very physics heavy. It was a lot of fun. I was always, you know, the annoying kid who was asking questions. How does this work? How does that work? And
but if you're going to homeschool a kid, you better expect to get a lot of questions.
Right. I figure it's on them. But I was always asking all these questions, and the answer, like 80 or 90% of the time, would be physics. It would always be, I ask a question, and not only was I lucky, my parents would usually know the answer, but they'd explain to me how the answer worked, and I could notice a pattern. It was always the same physics things answering my questions.
And how old were you when you started noticing that pattern? Were you like 9 or 10 or a little bit older?
It's hard to say.
To get it.
Yeah, my memory is really my most abysmal quality. So
welcome to my world.
It's hard to say exactly when I settled, but but pretty early on, I knew that I wanted to do some kind of physics, probably by 10 or 11 or something like that.
All right.
Then going on, my parents, you know, had been experimentalists. I went off to college, and as any good teenager does, I rebelled.
Of course.
So instead of becoming an experimentalist, I became a theorist.
How dare you?
Right. I was nearly disowned, but it's okay. And yeah, the rest is history. It's a lot of fun.
Okay. So you're a theorist. Then when did you make the switch back to, when did you come back to the fold? When did you make your parents proud again?
Well, I'm still a theorist.
Oh, okay.
I'm still a theoretical physicist. But the difference is sort of slight. I mean, experimentalists are the ones who actually have labs. They're the ones doing the real science, let's say. And the theorists are the ones who are sitting behind them in the offices, you know, working in with their pencil and paper and trying to build models and understand the data that the experimentalists are taking. So I realized at some point, whenever I touch things, they break, and so they wouldn't let me work in the lab. But if I instead sat in the office and focused on you know, trying to understand everything that the experimentalists were doing, I could still have fun doing physics, which is what I really wanted. I could still work on really interesting problems, which is what I really wanted.
Okay.
And I could be, you know, basically in a nice, happy spot.
Got it.
Very good fit.
So since your parents are, or, you know, have that physicist background, is there anything that you have learned as a physicist that didn't exist when they were coming up?
Because
I'm sure when you're at the dinner table, you guys are just, you're like, well, there's this, and they get excited, and they're like, well, do you remember this?
It's interesting. My parents, they both left the field around the time I was born, a little bit afterwards. I'm now 23, so they left around 20 years ago. And a lot has changed. The pace of change is not as rapid as it was in the 50s or the 60s, but we've discovered a lot of new things. And there are a few things that we thought that we no longer think. And so it's kind of fun. At some point, you know, instead of, I don't know exactly when the phase transition happened, but instead of me always calling up my mom or my dad to ask them a physics question, they would start calling me up to ask me a physics question. I was like, oh, I've made it. You know, it's
you're finally grown
right,
up.
Right. And it is fun. You know, my dad and I more so than my mom and I, when we're talking on the phone, we'll often talk about some new thing that's, you know, like the Nobel Prize, whenever it gets awarded, my dad will ask me some questions about, you know, who are these people? What were they working on? You know, what is the content of the Nobel Prize and whatnot? And because I understand so well what he knows and what his background is, it's always very easy to connect into that.
Okay. Isn't it nice, though, to be able to have these deep physics discussions with family?
It is. But I think even people who don't have family who, you know, like even physicists who don't have family who worked in physics, the nice thing about physics, I think, especially particle physics or cosmology or astrophysics, is they're questions that almost anyone can appreciate. And I think that's, like, I really like that aspect of physics, that unlike, let's say, some question in organic chemistry that is, you know, some very detailed discussion of how some certain molecule bonds to some other molecule in some organic system, you know, the questions that my group is asking, for example, they're questions that I can explain to you in 3 minutes what it is and why you should care. And you don't need any special training to understand the question. I mean, you need years and years to get to the point where you can sit alone in a dark, dimly lit office scratching out the answers on pencil and paper.
Okay.
But the questions are really universal. You know, it's what are we made of? Where did we come from? You know, what are the biggest structures in the universe? What are the smallest structures in the universe? How, you know, how does our understanding of how do the forces, the our understanding of the forces, you know, electricity, magnetism, gravity, mm-hmm. how do all these things fit together into some big picture? You know, we look out into the world and everyone has this experience, whether consciously or not. They look out into the world and they notice that the world is very structured, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a random place. There are very clear patterns and rules that govern the world. You know, when you drop something, it always falls the same way. Mm-hmm. And those understanding those patterns and rules is somehow a fundamental human drive. Like every human does pattern recognition very mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. That's one of our gifts as a species, I think. We're very good at like noticing that the same thing happens every single time and mm-hmm. then wondering, can we construct a theory that describes this so we can not just notice this abstract pattern, but predict it and harness it and, you know, perhaps use it for something else. So I am very lucky and I'm very happy that I can have these discussions, but I think it would be remiss to say that, you know, you have to have parents that are trained in physics to have these discussions. I think everyone is sort of curious about it, which is what makes it so fun. Unlike other scientists, I think if you put a particle physicist or a cosmologist or somebody like this, you know, uh-huh. you put them in a taxi.
Yeah.
They'll strike up a conversation with the taxi driver. And like I've had many times when people find out that I'm a physicist and they start asking some questions that they want to know the answers to. And I can say, oh, like it's I can like actually this. Give you the answers to that. That it's we know that. I mean, humanity has come very, very far in the past several millennia where now when you wonder, are there other planets out there? We don't have to guess. We can right. tell you, yes, there are. When you wonder, you know, how many stars are there in the sky? We don't have to guess. We can tell you, you know, like all of these things, they're questions that everyone has asked for mm-hmm. millennia mm-hmm. and, you know, everyone's curious about them.
What's the most exciting thing in your field right now? The thing that you gives you chills or when thrills when you think about, ooh, I get to study this, or ooh, we don't know the answer to that.
So I think
for you,
right,
not for anybody
right,
else,
for you. It's I'll refine this question slightly to mm-hmm. say there's a hierarchy between there are questions that, you know, are unbelievably interesting and I would love to know the answers to, mm-hmm. but I believe we won't get the answers to anytime soon.
Okay.
And then there are questions that are slightly less exciting, let's say, but more likely that we'll get the answers in the next 50 years.
Okay.
So I think dark matter is in the latter category.
Okay.
It is one of the most exciting, perhaps not the most exciting, mm-hmm. but very close to the top of questions that we really want to know the answer to mm-hmm. in the field. What is dark matter? I mean, there's a huge amount of stuff that's just floating around there in the universe, and we don't know what it is. We're not even the majority of stuff. Like, we meaning the normal, you know, protons and neutrons and electrons that mm-hmm. we all know and love that make up the table and, you know, you and me and whatnot. We're not in the majority. The majority of stuff in the universe is something that we have no idea what it is. And figuring that out, I think, will be incredibly exciting.
Okay.
And I think there's a pretty decent chance that we'll have made some progress, some pretty substantial progress in the next few decades. We're doing a ton of experiments, looking in a bunch of different places. The theories modeling has gotten a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Our telescopes are a lot better, so we can do really good measurements of, you know, we now are getting good data of not just that it's out there, but where it is. Like, where are the places where all this stuff
okay.
is clumped together?
Uh-huh.
You know, can we look in those places specifically for evidence of whatever it is? So dark matter is in that camp.
Okay.
I think if somebody comes to me and gives me the answer to what is dark matter before I die, I will be very happy.
Nice.
That'll be a good day.
Now, you mentioned earlier on that there are things that are orbiting around nothing, which people believe it's dark matter. But can they be sure it's dark matter and not just some sort of anomaly like, oh, this thing just likes to go around.
So, good. I'll say two things. One is dark matter itself. It's a really weak name for things because it literally is just stuff that we can't see. So anything, you know, it's even possible that it's not a new particle, that it's just, say, some black holes or something like that that we can't see because they're black. They don't emit light. You know, they're very dark.
Mm-hmm.
But that would fall into the camp of dark matter. When
okay.
we say dark matter, it's really stuff that we can't see in any of the normal ways that we're used to seeing, like
mm-hmm.
with our telescopes, for
mm-hmm.
example.
Mm-hmm.
With that being said, we also understand very well that, you know, going back to Newton, right, we have understood that if you see something accelerating, there must be a force acting on it.
Mm.
F equals ma.
Okay.
And so what we really look for is not just, oh, you know, some things happen to be moving in a weird way. We look for things that are accelerating.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're going in a circle, it turns out you're accelerating.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though you may not be getting faster or slower, you're changing the direction you're going in.
Okay.
So you can think about it.
Going straight. You have
exactly.
a curve and there's drag.
An acceleration. Well, acceleration always comes with a force. And you know that a force has to exist when you're turning, because, for example, you're in your car, you're on the highway, you make a sharp right turn and you'll be thrown against your left seat.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's because in order for you to make a right turn with the car,
mm-hmm.
you actually need to be a force to act on you to the right. And
so
you'll be thrown against the left side of your car and it'll push you around the turn. So we know if something's turning, there's an acceleration. That means there has to be a force. Force doesn't just come from nowhere,
mm-hmm.
at least not in all of our current understanding of physics. You know, we really understand sort of F equals ma, right? We
sure,
think
sure.
we've understood these things for 400 years,
mm-hmm.
300 years. And so what we do is we say, okay, something's accelerating. There must be a force. What could that force be coming from? Usually it's gravity. It's coming from something
mm-hmm.
that it's orbiting, like the sun gravitationally attracting the Earth. And then you look where it's orbiting and there's nothing there.
Okay.
This, by the way, is also how we know. So there are black holes that we do know exist. And some of those we know that they exist because of exactly this. We see a bunch of stars orbiting nothing.
What
is there? Well,
okay.
it's something that has to be incredibly massive and incredibly small, and the only thing that can be is a black hole.
Got it. We just have like 2 minutes left, and I wish I had another half hour with you because I have so many questions. I'm going to ask you two more questions. Question number one, are there ever any types of orbits where they have a force acting, more than one force acting upon it, number one. And then number two, if people want to find out more about what you do, how do they go about doing that? So
good. So the first question is definitely yes. I mean, when something's moving, it's not just one thing acts on it, everything acts on it.
Mm-hmm.
And what's the simplest example? Well, let's say the moon. The moon is orbiting around the Earth,
mm-hmm.
but the Earth is orbiting around the sun.
Mm-hmm.
And so the sun is pulling the Earth. It's also pulling the moon.
Okay.
And if those two things were separate, then the moon would just go around in exactly the same way that the Earth does, because the Earth is also there. The
okay.
moon not just goes around the sun, it also, you know, does an extra loop around
got
the
it,
Earth.
Got it.
Funnily enough, this problem of three things orbiting each other
uh-huh.
is remarkably difficult. This is called the three-body problem, and
uh-huh.
it's a problem that, you know, it's easy to describe. People have known about it for hundreds of years. Nobody's been able to solve it.
Okay.
So it
so
like
the next
solve
big
exactly
genius.
Exactly how it works. We know. I mean, we can simulate it. We know
mm-hmm.
on a computer how it works. And the last thing is, if you're curious,
yes.
there are a lot of great science programs. I won't recommend any one in particular, but
mm-hmm.
I think there are a lot of scientists who love to talk to people. If you
mm-hmm.
know any scientists, you should just ask them questions because most of them love to talk. If you're curious about particle physics in particular, CERN, the
mm-hmm.
Large Hadron Collider,
mm-hmm.
has a website where they have a lot of really excellent science outreach and, you know, educational videos and programs like that. So if you
okay.
Google Large Hadron Collider, CERN,
mm-hmm.
you'll find more and more information than you could possibly desire.
And if people want to find out specifically about what you are doing, what you, Jet Thompson, are doing.
Yeah. Well, of course, you can look up my papers. Sure. So you can if you Google my name, mm-hmm. Jedediah Oliver Thompson, then, some papers will come up and you can read them. Mm-hmm. But this is, I will say, not the place that you should start. I mean, I love what I do. I think it's really important. But the way I describe it is, humans know the average human, any one person knows a very little bit of stuff. Mm-hmm. Humanity as a whole knows a lot of stuff. What any one scientist is working on is some tiny little dot somewhere on that frontier. But if you want to get involved and get started, it's not worth looking at that one little dot that I'm working on. Biggest thing to do is start understanding the massive, sea of knowledge that we already know, right? To get to the frontier, you first want to explore the paths that have already been well-trodden.
Well, Jedediah Thompson, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Of course. Thank you for having me. It's a lot of fun.
People of Earth, science, that's all I can say. And that is all I had to say with Jedediah Thompson. And speaking of reams and reams of knowledge, you know how I feel about the library. And you know how I feel about my librarianistas. And I've got the head librarianista. I'd like to welcome Janine Moghanim. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. Now, for those of our listeners who don't know, KPOO is located on DeVis near Geary, and Janine's branch is the station's sort of local branch. So can you tell us a little bit about your branch?
I would love to. The branch is called the Western Edition Branch. Mm-hmm. We serve the Western Edition community, which encompasses the Fillmore, Japantown, the area now known as NOPA, which is basically the historical, also Western Addition. Mm-hmm. So that general part of town. And we're a beautiful little mid-century medium-sized library branch, and we're pretty busy all day, every day, serving the diverse communities of the Western Addition and beyond.
Okay, so I've been physically in the branch, but for our listening audience who hasn't been to that branch, let me back up. Do all the libraries have kind of a niche that they within the system, or is it pretty much the same from one branch to another?
Some do have a sort of niche, but all the branches have what we call like general interest collections. Mm-hmm. So we will have like the newest and most popular titles, whether it's books, music, movies, all of that. Mm-hmm. We also have the classics and a selection of items that you come to expect, as well as a varied selection of programming. Mm-hmm. And we all serve all ages and all aspects of our community. That said, there are certain branches that because of their history or location sort of focus on serving certain particular community groups. So, for example, at Western Addition Branch, although we serve everyone, we're home to the largest collection of Japanese books in Northern California, I believe.
Okay.
So that's something pretty special and unique that we feature, as well as a very large collection of Black interest, African-American interest titles, being that we are located in the historically Black and African-American Fillmore neighborhood.
Very good. Very good. So January is fast ending. February is about to begin. What sorts of things are happening for the month of February?
Oh, many things, as usual. Mm-hmm. first and foremost, I would love to welcome everyone to attend our Western Edition branch open house, which is kicking off February on Saturday, February 3rd, which is this coming Saturday, from 1 to 5 p.m. And as you know, Marilyn, our open house is a large community event for all ages. We have community partners coming to visit and distribute information, as KPOO, the Western Edition Family Resource Center, Home Match, and others. We've also got the Museum of Craft and Design coming by with their craft stand to do crafts throughout the day. We have local favorites, Six Roses, the jazz duo, performing at 3:30.
Were they there the last year?
They were here last year. Yeah, they were there last year. Yeah, we love having them.
Yeah, they're good.
They're always popular.
Go on.
And we're going to have refreshments, little snacks. We're going to have a little all ages librarian story time. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
And that's this Saturday from 1 to 5.
That's right, at Western Edition Branch. Yes. And we're on the corner of Scott and Geary Street.
Yes. And in case you, my listening audience didn't notice, KPOO will have a table there. So, you know, come on down. So what else you got going on for the month of February?
The month of February. We've got, so we have the return of our bi-monthly, I guess, Japanese language story time. So the Western Edition branch actually has a dedicated Japanese language librarian. And she's doing the story time on the second and fourth Thursdays of each month at 11 a.m.
Oh, very nice.
So for any families with young children, basically ages like 5 and younger, you can bring your kids over and sort of work on your Japanese, learning your Japanese knowledge. It is mostly in Japanese, so it helps to have some base knowledge of the language, but it's open to everyone after all our programs. So we're excited to have that back. And then on Monday, February 12th, we're having one of a series of yoga workshops with the Tendwell Collective. It's a gentle yoga class for all ages and experience levels.
What, you have yoga in the library?
Indeed, we do.
Wow. Well, it is a quiet. It is a quiet exercise. So
it is. It's a quiet exercise. Exactly. And you don't need to have any experience. You should just bring a mat if you have one. We do have a limited number to borrow. And it's just very calming, soothing exercise. It's at 11 a.m. on Monday, February 12th.
And is that for all ages, or is there a, low end to the age?
All ages, all experience levels.
Okay. And you've done that before, yes or no?
We have hosted it, yes.
Okay.
At the library, yeah.
Okay. All right. And then is next month, so next month is, you know, African American History Month. Do you, does the library system have anything special planned for that month?
Yes, plenty. I was hoping you would ask. So at SFPL, we call it More Than a Month because to honor the fact that Black history is year round. And we start celebrating on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday weekend. So already in the swing of things, but February is really when it gets going. So I do want to highlight that there is an exhibition at the main library right now called Toward a Black Aesthetic, Kenneth P. Green Sr.'s Photographs of the 1960s and 70s. So Kenneth P. Green was the first Black photographer for the Oakland Tribune.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And the exhibition focuses on his images of Black women whose strength, intellect, and beauty he recognized and paid homage to through his photographs, which also highlights the fashion and politics of the 60s and 70s.
Very nice. And where is that? Is that like on the sixth floor or the fifth? You know, because I know that they disperse them throughout the library.
Indeed, they do. I believe. One moment. The Jewett Gallery, so it's the lower level.
Oh, okay. So when you go.
And the African American Center on the third floor.
Okay.
Sorry. So both.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. Excellent.
Yes. And then in terms of programming, there is going to be a Zoom event. So for those who may not be able to attend in person, this is accessible to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Tania Lunsford-Link will be in conversation with Albert Broussard on Wednesday, February 7th from 6 to 7:30 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's virtual. So you'll go to our website, sfpl.org, to register.
Okay.
So Tania and Albert will be discussing the early African-American presence in San Francisco, centering on a 1978 oral history interview between Broussard and Aurelius Alverga, who was an African-American gentleman born in San Francisco in 1884. So this will be a very historical and enlightening conversation.
Very nice. Very nice.
Yes. And this is part of like a sort of research project that Tania Lunsford-Link did through the San Francisco Arts Commission's Artist in Residence program. She listened to Alverga's stories via and read the transcripts, and so this is kind of part of that that research project.
Very nice, very nice. Now I'm on your website, and I don't want to derail the talks about the different programs, but I see that there's a list of books about grief and loss for children and families. What prompted that?
That's a good question. I know that our library, especially, we have a sort of readers advisory committee, and they, as well as other library staff, create many reading lists.
Mm-hmm.
As a way to sort of give suggestions to the community, without,
sure.
You know, even if you're just looking online and not coming into the library in person.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't say for sure, but I will take a wager that considering, you know, the past 2 years, I think, especially since you know, the pandemic started, children, as well as everybody, but actually children have sort of been brought to knowledge of grief and loss in new ways, right, in different ways. And that's continuing now with all sorts of events happening in the world and being more aware of them via media. And so I imagine that this probably came about as a way to highlight the many books that are now being written to acknowledge that very, like, important emotional aspect of a child's life, often very confusing for children.
Sure.
And so, you know, these books sort of help children to make sense or at least feel comforted in the knowledge that they're not the only ones who are feeling this way, and, you know, the feelings don't always last forever. You know, sort of all the things we want to teach children about grief and loss, but may not be able to convey in just a, you know, a conversation.
Sure, sure, sure. Now, you did talk about, like, you guys make a number of reading lists, and I have always appreciated those because I can grab like one of the bookmarks and it'll be like, for example, during Halloween, I was able to grab a horror bookmark and it had the list of books to read. With that in mind, is there going to be a bookmark for, you know, African, you know, for more than a month?
I don't know that there will be a bookmark, mm-hmm. per se, but there will certainly be a book list available online. It's already actually there, so if you were to go to our library's website, sfcl.org,
mm-hmm.
and on the initial homepage there's More Than a Month is featured, so if you click on the large icon there,
mm-hmm.
You'd see the More Than a Month page, so you can read about what's going on, and then if you were to scroll down, you would be able to see the various More Than a Month book list.
Sure.
So right now we have featured books on art and artists.
Mm-hmm.
We've got kids books, teen books, and then general adult fiction, nonfiction, and even film and video.
Fair enough.
And with these book lists each year, we try to highlight, you know, newer books that have come out that folks may not be aware of yet, to sort of get them into the public eye and public awareness.
So when all of these new books come out, is there one person who's in charge of reading them, or is it a team effort to read all of the books, or do you just take the, like, recommendations from other libraries? How does it work?
That's a good question. And I am not on the Reader's Advisory Committee, so I wouldn't necessarily know how they go about doing it when they create lists.
Mm-hmm.
I do know that when we have these Cultural Awareness Month,
mm-hmm.
There are often subcommittees that will, you know, work on the programming and also creating the list.
Mm-hmm.
So when I have done so in the past, or contributed to this list making in the past, oftentimes I will include books that I have read or at least read part of.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really possible to read every book. So I would say, like, it's the process is a combination of, you know, books that you read and can personally recommend, and then books that through your professional knowledge and professional resources,
mm-hmm.
You're aware of and know that this may be of interest to our patrons and is, you know, important to include on our list.
Well, is there a book you've recently read or, you know, read in the last year that you thought, I want more people to read this book? This was I really enjoyed this book.
I mean, always.
I want to hear them.
Well, as you may have heard me mention before, I do like to read graphic novels.
Mm-hmm.
Leaning towards the, like, personal narrative / memoir.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But a variety. And so currently I'm reading one that actually just won several youth media awards from, mm-hmm. the American Library Association.
Mm-hmm.
Awards and honors, excuse me.
Okay.
It's called Mexikid by Pedro Martin.
Uh-huh.
And so this won the Newbery Honor and also the Cora Beltre Children's Author and Illustrator Awards. And so Mexikid is a graphic memoir set in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
About a kid named Pedro and his large family. He has, I think, something like 8 or 9 siblings.
Wow.
And they go, they go on a road trip from California to Mexico in their Winnebago, and they're on their way to bring their grandfather home to live with them.
Mm-hmm.
But first they must help him accomplish a special mission.
Hmm.
And so this book is really unique because it incorporates, it's a graphic novel, right? So it's like a in comic form, but it's much more than just, you know, comic strips. He incorporates very creative elements of sort of like a little bit of interview, a little bit of like superhero inspired, because the kid really likes superheroes, like Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
It's very humorous. It's very self-aware. So I just think it's like a really great middle grade level graphic novel for young folks and for everyone.
Very good. Very good. What other, since I know you read a lot, was there another one that you were like, wow, you know, that you would want people to go, to take an extra look at?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, continuing on this theme mm-hmm. of graphic novel memoirs and families, about family and culture, there's one called Family Style, Memories of an American from Vietnam mm-hmm. by Tien Pham. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. But so this book is about Pham's experience as a refugee, being a refugee from Vietnam. His family fled when he was very young. They ended up at a refugee camp in Thailand, and then eventually they're able to come to the United States, I believe the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. And it's told sort of, each little chapter focuses on a certain food item mm-hmm. that has significance in that part of their life story.
Okay.
And so he says, my first memory isn't a sight or sound. It's the sweetness of watermelon and the saltiness of fish. It's the taste of foods eaten while adrift at sea as his family fled Vietnam. And so each chapter of their lives is represented by a certain food and the meaning that food has in their lives. So it's a very poignant and touching and beautiful sort of testimony to family mm-hmm. and culture and food and not losing sight of, you know, who you are and where you come from, even as you kind of become somebody new over the course of your life.
Yeah, you had me at food. What's that? What's the title of that one again?
It's called Family Style.
And who's the author?
Tien Pham.
Okay.
Pham is how you spell the author's last name.
Okay, and I feel I've derailed you, and we've only got a few minutes. So, are there some other programs that you would like our listening audience to know about?
Well, something of interest, I think, to the KPOO audience mm-hmm. is that the library is now accepting nominations for the 9th San Francisco Poet Laureate.
Ooh.
Well, not just the library, but the city. Uh-huh. Yes, and so our current poet laureate, for those who don't know, is the wonderful Tongo Eisen Martin. But his tenure is coming to an end, mm-hmm. and so we're looking for a new poet laureate. The nominees must be San Francisco residents, have a substantial body of published work, mm-hmm. including at least one full-length book, and a professional digital recording of performance with text.
And so go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, or 20 or more published poems in established publications over the past 5 years.
And how do people go about nominating them via the library?
Yes. So you would go on to sfpl.org, mm-hmm. the library's website, mm-hmm. and there is a nomination form. So again, on that landing page, there's a large icon that says Nominations Open, San Francisco Poet Laureate. So you'll just click there. And it'll take you to the nomination form, as well as more information about eligibility and who the selection committee is for this year.
Okay. All right.
And the deadline is February 16th.
February 16th?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, Janine Moghanam, I could easily have had you on for the whole show to talk about everything that's going on in the library, but sadly, the hour has come to an end. So I want to thank you so much, not just for being on the show today, but really thank all the librarians for all they do, because it's an amazing thing to be able to walk into a building and just read a book. You know, you don't have to be rich. You don't have to be connected. You just need a library card.
There you go.
All right. So thank you so much.
Glad to be a part of that. Of course. Thank you.
All right. Okay, people of Earth. The library, it's a resource for everybody. So it's time for me to turn the mic over to Mr. Ford. It'll be pleasuring your ear hole. I'm going to leave you with some Ornette Coleman. This is science fiction. So until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.